You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Welcome back, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the break. My name is Hillary Hoynes. I'm a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, and I'm pleased to be moderating this third panel this morning. And the topic of the third panel is work and poverty. As with the other panels, we're going to start with a presentation and then hear some opening statements from our esteemed panelists, then have a conversation on the stage, and then open it to questions from the audience. So I'm very pleased to start by announcing our speaker for this panel, Robert Moffitt. Robert is the Krieger Eisenhower Professor of Economics at Johns Hopkins University. He's a labor economist and public economist who has written extensively on precisely what we're focused on talking about today, and more broadly on the effects of government tax and transfer programs on labor supply, program participation, and demography. I don't have enough time to read all of his many distinctions, but he's been president of the Population Association of America, was the lead editor of the American Economic Review for 6 years, recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, and perhaps most relevant to our conversation today, was chair of the National Academy of Sciences panel to evaluate welfare reform. What year was that, Robert? 2001. So join me in welcoming Robert Moffitt.
Thanks, Hillary. I want to say that I'm only one among many people who have done a lot of important work on, not my is important, but other people's on welfare and the effects on work and poverty, including Hillary and a lot of people in the room. Nice to see a lot of people here I haven't seen in 20 years. So I want to apologize for having missed the earlier sessions, and I'm actually running another conference today across town, and I'm going to have to run back there right after this, but I'll be back. And so if you'd like to talk further, I apologize for not having much time after the session, but I'll be back later. Okay, so let's see here. 20 years after the Welfare to Work Act. So I'm going to try to summarize what I see the research shows. I'm going to try to stick pretty much to what I think the number of research summaries have shown. It doesn't always speak for itself, so I'm going to give you my interpretation of that evidence where it's ambiguous most of the time. And hopefully then we can have a good discussion afterwards about both whether I'm right about the facts and also, of course, what their implications are for what we might want to do today. I feel a little silly. Some of this audience knows this stuff so well, they probably have their own minds made up. Anyway, so the work and poverty, so a huge amount done. As most of the people who worked in this area know, however, a lot of it was done right after the 1996 law was passed, and it's kind of tailed off. A lot of different kinds of work was done, including randomized trials, but I'll talk about that. But because it kind of died out, there wasn't a lot of work done on, I think, just a very important subsequent act, which was the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, and we don't know nearly as much about that, I would say. I'm going to sum most a lot of the research I'm talking about here is, in fact, a little. Oops, I think it cycles maybe. No. Okay. Not sure what I did there. Okay. I have one slide here for the methodologists in the audience, but it was a very difficult reform to evaluate. And in fact, that panel I chaired was really a methodological panel. How should we evaluate this thing? And what are all the different methods? And we went through all the methods and said, this one can answer that question. This one can answer the other question, and tried to also make recommendations for future similar kinds of reforms. So this is a list of some of the kind of obvious problems that at least after 1996, the reform was adopted in all the states, at least in basic structure, so you had no cross-sectional, cross-state variation. You did have some in some supplemental optional components of reform. There was more state variation prior to 1996, but some of those waivers didn't really match up exactly with the 1996 law, and very few of them adopted all the components, and a lot of people think here it was the adoption of a lot of components simultaneously that had extra effect. The economy was doing very well, and I'll talk more about that right after 1996, so disentangling the effects of that from reform. The EITC has disillusionedly been liberalized, and a lot of people think the effects were still being felt. I won't talk about data deficiencies, but there are many and are continuing to be talked about today. Lots of problems in finding out exactly what states were doing. I'm happy to say the Urban Institute picked up that ball, and now they have a very good website, which is about the best place in the country to go if you want to find out what states are doing. But that took a while to establish. So anyway, so I said I'm going to try to summarize the search, and I just want to put up here to thank Jeff Groger and Lynn Carrilly and Jim Ziliak for an edited volume he did 10 years after reform, and then for a very recent paper he's done summarizing the research on the TANF program, and all those were invaluable. And to refresh my memory on all the studies, I relied pretty heavily on those, not exclusively, of course. Okay, so I'm going to summarize the findings and try to do so as briefly as I can so we can get on to the discussion here. And I actually do have a first set of slides here on what researchers think about the effects on caseloads. And then I'm going to turn to work and employment and then income and poverty. In this case, I'm going to show you the time series graph of what's happened since 1996, sometimes a little bit before. And then I'm going to talk about the research evidence, and I don't need to belabor the obvious, but all researchers know that the time series graphs by themselves don't reveal the answer to the question you want, which is you want to know what would have happened in the absence of the reform, so it's a counterfactual, and there's absolutely no reason why the answer to that research question about what would have happened otherwise is going to line up exactly with the before and after when you look at the time series. Having said that, it's a I think very useful to start off with just looking at the trend. So here I have a graph which I stole from Jim Ziliak, so you can see it many different places. The more important line here is the dark line, which rose in the 1960s. That's the line of the caseload, number of size of the AFDC caseload as it was then. And you can see that it rose in the kind of welfare explosion of the 1960s. It flattened out during the 70s and 80s. And then kind of interesting that it rose a lot right before the reform, which a lot of other people have commented on, and whether that was any reason for the enactment of the reform is something, you know, maybe I'll leave to other political analysts, but in any case, it did rise quite a bit right before the reform, and then it started falling actually a little bit before 1996, perhaps because of the enactment of waivers, but also the economy was also improving then. In fact, they do have a slide here on the unemployment rate, just to refresh your memory here, that only starting in 1990, we had a recession in the early 90s, but starting about that same time. So you see 1993 is about when that unemployment rate peaked, and then we started entering into a very very healthy economic environment right at exactly the same time, even way before 1996, the same time the waivers were being introduced. And you can see the unemployment rate fell all the way to 4% by 2000, and that caused analysts endless headaches. So, but I'll point out too that the unemployment rate jumped up later in the early 2000s. We had we then called a mild recession, and that's compared to the one before and the one after, and then of course a very large recession, the Great Recession, which began 2007, 2008. So, anyway, back to the line. So we had this enormous drop in the caseload right after the 1990s, and it continued dropping. If you look for the later recessions, you'll see only a very tiny, tiny little bump. So the early 2000s, when we had that so-called mild recession, the caseload went up a little bit, you can see there. And then even in the 2008, 2011 recession, see a small bump there. And a lot have been written on that, which I don't have time to talk about, but a lot of that increase in the Great Recession Commission, which was a result of emergency monies provided by Congress on a temporary basis to the TANF program. And that also is an average over states, and some of the states actually had declines in the caseload over this period. So it was quite an interesting phenomenon, which I'll comment on in a second. So anyway, so what about the research evidence, which has tried to disentangle all these things and find out what the net effect of welfare reform was? Lots of estimates. In fact, it turned out to be quite difficult. Jim Zilliak has actually done as much work on this as anybody else in trying to disentangle. Basically, what most people are doing is looking across different states. Like I said, everybody had to pretty much enact the basic structures of the reform, but they all had different unemployment rates, and they were changing at different amounts over time. So that gives you a little bit of leverage. A lot of the studies, in fact, were over the waiver period, which has the problem that it's not TANF. And the range, if you just restrict yourself to the studies that tried to do something post-1996, my personal range when looking at the estimates is about 18% to 35% of that big reduction you saw was due to the reform, and that's less than 50%. So that's saying that a lot of it was due to the economy. And I should say that, remember, most of these studies were conducted through maybe 2000 and not much later than that. So whether that's the same today, or not is quite different. But my own take, so here's my own take on this, which is that those little blips in the 2000s and the Great Recession indicate to me that, in fact, the reform is pretty important here. Everyone was waiting in 1996 and 1997, let's wait for the unemployment rate to go up and see, which one. That's the final test to see whether it was reform or the economy. Well, the unemployment rate's gone up twice, and the caseload did not go back anywhere up to where it was. So now maybe there's something else going on. Maybe it's the EITC. It's keeping people off welfare or something like that. But anyway, my take is I think 18 to 35% from today's perspective is too small. So maybe other people would like to comment on that during the discussion period. Turn to my second outcome, employment. Again, here's one graph. And here I'm plotting not only the employment rates of the primary recipient group of the TANF and AFTC programs, namely single mothers, when in this case only the never married group, so it's the more worse off group actually than divorced and separated women. And that's the red line. And the blue line are single women with no children. You can do a lot of different comparison groups here. You can compare single mothers who have low education versus those with high education. You can compare them to married women. And in every case, you find what you see here, which is that the employment rates of these mothers who were most eligible for AFDC and TAN have climbed pretty dramatically starting in the waiver period and continuing after 1996. And in fact, for this particular comparison group, usually what it does is shows a narrowing. This is a little exceptional, I would say, compared to some of the other comparisons, because here it shows they exactly went up and actually matched the employment rates of single women. But whether you think it matches it or just gets closer isn't really important. The point is that their employment rates went up a lot. But once again, was that the economy? Was that the earned income tax credit? What was it? Or was it something else? As the research shows on that, I think there's been, again, quite a bit of efforts to disentangle these other factors on employment. There were these lever studies, which aren't quite in the same category as these counterfactual studies, but they did show that compared to women, looking at women who had been on AFTC, and on AFTC, the employment rates of women while they were on the rolls was never more than about 10 or 15% of those who left during this admittedly very good employment period. We're in the range of 60 to 70%. And you can say a lot of things about that. Some of those were only point in time. They couldn't stay employed. But still, I think everyone's reaction at the time, and I think still, is that those are probably higher than one would have expected, given that they were women, like I said, who had rarely worked when they were on AFTC. So how much due to one versus the other? Again, the many attempts to disentangle that. A rough range, 2 to 4 percentage points was due to the policy, which if you go back to that graph, that's about half. So that's about 50% of the increase was due solely to reform. So I'm going to say a little bit more about that later, exactly how that happened in a couple of slides. A lot of the studies do show the EITC was very important, and the EITC liberalizations of the late 80s and early 90s in making earnings off welfare in particular more attractive and allowing women to have decent incomes if they left the rolls. Some studies that have gone a little bit further suggest that those employment effects have faded out, particularly if you look at lines where there was a catch-up between, let's say, lower-educated single mothers and higher-educated ones. It's kind of the catch-up is over, and it kind of flattened out, and there's no more, don't see any more gains. So that is to say there weren't any. It's just that there might have been a short-term gain here, but no further improvements beyond that. Okay, now poverty. Again, what graph are here? Okay, here is a graph I stole from Chris Weimer and his colleagues. They've been, I don't know what a lot of you here know, they've been publishing a lot of new calculations of poverty rates adapted from the supplemental poverty measure that the Census Bureau has been calculating, which are based upon the National Academy study, 1995. You can quibble with a lot of the things that are going into this, but nevertheless, I regard it as a pretty good measure, and certainly better than the official government poverty rate. So if you look at that, and you look at their numbers, some of these are unpublished, by the way. Chris kindly gave them to me, from 1968 to 2013. And you look at the poverty rate, what you see is that they did decline over the early 1970s and 80s, a bit bump up in the around the 1980s recession, but it has pretty much declined since then, and it continued to decline after 1996, but it's since kind of flattened out. I've seen a number of other people do different definitions of poverty rates, and I think a lot of them show really the same thing as far as a decline starting before 1996 and continuing afterwards, and then kind of either a flattening out or a slowdown in that rate of decline. But very important to the people who are looking at these numbers is the rate of deep poverty, which is defined as the fraction of families whose incomes are below 50% of the poverty line. And if you see that, you see a slight decline after 1996 compared to before, but really not nearly as much as the overall poverty rate, which is telling you definitionally that most of that decline in the poverty rate was from families who were fewer families between 50% and 100% of the poverty line who are now above the line, and not too much difference in the number of families or fraction of families who are below 50% of the poverty line. So that's an important fact, I think, that has to be on the table, that the distributional effect here is quite different depending upon how poor you were. And so I'll come back to that and mention that as well. And certainly also definitionally today, the fraction of all poor who are in deep poverty, way down at the bottom, that fraction is certainly higher than it was prior to 1996. What have the researchers found in their attempts to disentangle the effects of the reform from other things? Well, we know employment went up, so the question here, did their earnings go up, and did it go up enough to counteract the effect of welfare benefits if they went off rolls, which most families did, if you remember that line I showed you before, that drastic decline in the caseload. And as I said just in the graph, the poverty rates did fall a little bit after 1996, but you've got the economy and the EITC. I found the studies in this area to be particularly all over the map, and so rather difficult to really, I don't have a range here like I did for the others. I didn't feel as though I could do that. I do think that most of them showed there was certainly some impact of the impact on the reform itself on the poverty rate. So I would never go to this research literature and conclude it was zero. But however, the problem is a number of studies showed that total incomes, average incomes didn't change a whole lot, that for a large number of families, the gains in earnings weren't that much greater, even if you include the EITC, weren't that much greater than the loss of benefits, so the total income didn't go up a whole lot. And furthermore, as I said, a lot of these studies seem to suggest that the effects on poverty to the extent that they occurred were, as I just said, mostly above the slightly better off poor and not the the deep poor. One of the really important things, I think, when you get to this is that you can talk about averages all day long here, but I think we really need to go move away from averages. There's a distribution of effects here, whether you talk about employment and earnings, income, poverty, and I'm convinced that a lot of former welfare recipients and female head families today are better off and have higher incomes and are working, but a lot of them are not. And I think the research evidence is consistent with that in a number of dimensions, and I can talk about specific studies if people are interested later. Okay, so one final slide, and then I'll conclude. The final slide here is about components. So everything I've talked about is just the overall effect of all of welfare reform together. And we know that welfare reform is composed of many pieces, and there are some very key ones, like the work requirements, like the time limits, the sanctions, which kind of go along with the work requirements, and, of course, the block grant restrictions, which I'm not going to talk about in great detail. That's a little bit outside the scope of what I had here. And if you look at the research evidence, I think it's fair to say that most researchers who tried to really take into account all these major factors and disentangle them and say which ones, suppose you believe all the total effects I just showed you, which of these components was most responsible? And put that in a counterfactual way, suppose I'd only done work requirements and nothing else, or only sanctions and nothing else, or only time limits and nothing else, what would have been the effect? And I think it's fair to say we don't know. The people have not been successful. These things all happened at once in all states. There were some variations. We have the waiver period where some people did some things, but you just can't disentangle these things. And again, I could talk about the methodological problems there, but certainly that Jim Jeliak's conclusion, I think, when he did his review, and it's been my view and my perception is many, many researchers agree with that general conclusion, which is unfortunate, of course, because today that's what we'd like to know. If you just change the block grant but left time limits and work requirements all the same, what would happen? Or if you just change the work requirements, and I don't think we know that. Now, actually, talking about today, it's even more difficult. Even if we knew the answer to that, I think a lot of people would say that the program has changed. The block grant situation today is different than it was. DRA has come in. The work requirements are all different. I'm not sure even if we knew the answer to the post-1996, it was very helpful to 2016. So it is a very difficult problem to answer with the kind of solid, incredible research evidence we want. So my final this slide here just says my reading there should just summarize the reform did lower the caseloads, and that my view is the magnitude has increased over time. I guess it didn't talk about it in too much detail. It raised average employment rates, but not for all. It did have somewhat positive effects on average income, and probably lowered overall poverty rates to some extent, but also may have increased deep poverty rates. So that's it.
Thank you very much, Robert. We've got a fabulous panel of four. We have more than the last two panels because work and poverty is super important. And we're really fortunate to have four people who have thought a lot about these issues, and I'm very excited for the conversation. So moving from Robert and towards the audience's left, We're going in alphabetical order as the prior panel. Next to Robert, we have Sheldon Danziger, who's the president of the Russell Sage Foundation, and he's on leave as the Henry J. Meyer Distinguished University Professor of Public Policy at the University of Michigan and the prior director of the National Poverty Center at Michigan. Next to Sheldon, we have Larry Mead, who's a professor of politics and public policy at New York University, and also has an appointment here in Washington as a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Next, we have Ron Mincy, who's the Maurice V. Russell Professor of Social Policy and Social Work Practice at Columbia University, and the co-PI of the important Fragile Families and Child Well-Being Survey. And last but not least, on the end, we have Mike Tanner, who's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, written numerous books on public policy, a range of issues, and current focus is on innovative solutions to poverty and inequality. So we'll start with Sheldon with the opening statements.
Thanks. I have some prepared remarks and then a lot of scribbles based on the earlier two sessions, which I thought were terrific. So the first thing I'd start with that I wrote after hearing the last session is if we concluded there that we might have paid too much attention to marriage before knowing how to make changes, I want to argue that we didn't pay enough attention to work opportunities, even though we certainly know that if you provide people jobs, more people will take them and work. And seeing Wendell Primus in the audience, I thought, oh, but they were there in that first bill that the Clinton administration introduced in the summer of 1994 that was actually, I think, mainly derailed by liberal Democrats who argued that work requirements coupled with work opportunities was too harsh. And obviously, what I'm going to argue is having implemented work requirements, the problem is we didn't really provide work opportunities. That wasn't such a problem, as people have said, in the five years post-welfare reform when we had 4% unemployment rate, but it's a serious problem in the economy we've had for the last 10 or so years. So I think most people would agree with the consensus that we heard in the first panel from Ron Haskins and in Robert's presentation, that it was a combination of welfare reform, positive policy changes, the extension of CHIP, SIP, the EITC, the rising minimum wage, and the labor shortage economy. I would also emphasize something that Robert said, but I would refer people to his demography paper where he really shows, in some ways, it's never been better to be a minimum wage poor worker because you get all these supplements that we talked about. But it's also never been worse to be somebody who can't work, say because you have health problems or mental health problems or skill shortages or domestic violence, learning disabilities, a lot of things that in our Michigan study on the barriers to employment, we sort of only started looking at those after welfare reform. In part, you could go on AFDC and get a check, and nobody bothered to see whether there was a problem. I would argue they've been neglected too much. I think the disconnected, a lot of them have these problems, and we still, I think Lonnie Berger touched on that in his comments. And that is part of the reason why some people have sporadic work, even when the economy is good. And I think it's the reason that some people can't even get jobs. I also think over this period, it's not just the economy has changed or welfare reform. I think there have been changes in employer practices that make it much harder for people with low education and low skills, whether welfare recipients, long-term unemployed, or even 55-year-old workers who had long work histories who were laid off in the recession. And the computerized job applications and algorithms that just skip people who have big employment gaps make it a lot harder for people who want to work to get employment. So I would argue that the key thing going forward is that the emphasis on personal responsibility, I think, clearly mattered. I'm not arguing we go back to the AFDC world, but I think we need a balance of public responsibility with work opportunities. And here I'm actually going to read a quote from the AEI Brookings Working Group that a number of us in this room were on, because I think we managed to strike a consensus that is important going forward. This is a quote: "We believe that the emergence of a work support system promoted by the 1996 welfare reform law should be accompanied by public efforts to ensure that work is widely available to all or nearly all low-income adults who want it. We can't assume that enough jobs are always available for all those who need them, especially for the hard to employ, those facing multiple barriers to work, those who lived in depressed regions and during economic downturns. One way to create jobs is to subsidize employers' hiring of hard-to-employ groups. Another way to provide jobs is public service employment." So I think that's really important going forward, and if our group could agree on that, I think that's a good sign. I would also just touch on a few things that were said in the early session this morning: Jane Waldfogel's argument about the need for more child care, the need for EITC for single people, and particularly for some sort of short-term disability program for people who have things like depression that are episodic and mean they can work sporadically. In the old days, they could go on and off AFDC. That doesn't happen anymore. Thanks.
Okay. Reform's greatest achievement was that it raised work levels among many people who weren't previously employed. Especially, it raised work levels among welfare mothers so that about a third of them were working. This is why they were on the rolls. Those demands were the main reason why two-thirds of them left the rolls and most of the leavers went to work. But even more important, reform also raised work levels in the general population, even among people who were not on welfare. In 93, only 44% of poor single mothers with children worked at all, only 9% full-time, full year. By 1999, 64% worked, 17% full-time and full year. And there was some decline after that, as others have said, but the levels are still much above what they were before reform. This is the greatest gain in work levels among poor adults that government has ever achieved. And we need to ask how. And there's a mystery here, because the effects are much larger than the impacts that welfare work programs had shown in the MDRC evaluations. How often do we see new social programs do better, not worse, when they are taken to scale? But that's what happened here. We have something close to a revolution in work levels with transforming effects on the whole welfare system and on those who are helped by that system, way beyond what research had anticipated. There were massive diversion effects that were far larger than anything that happened in work programs per se. Many, many poor mothers got a message that somehow work was now expected more seriously than before, and many of them went out and got work without ever going on welfare at all. This is the great mystery, and this was the greatest achievement of reform. Now, among the causes, as others have said, were a good economy and other programs, notably EITC. But in my view, these effects are secondary to the change in welfare policy. And as others have said, something else must be going on here. As Robert says, the effects were larger than we could have expected. Now, I actually ran a conference at AEI in 2008 to ask that question of field researchers who'd been involved in watching reform at the local level. I said, why were the effects so much larger than anyone expected? And they said a number of things, but what really drove reform, according to them, was a change in public expectations. Government in general, and ultimately public opinion, made it clear that a work demand was now more serious than before, and the welfare population and other poor women responded to that. So welfare reform is kind of like the starter motor on the car. It's necessary to create credibility on the ground for work requirement. It's good enough to turn over the main engine on the car, but the main engine is much stronger than the starter motor. And the main engine in America, the thing ultimately governs America, is public opinion. And opinion was impatient that welfare mothers should go to work, particularly at that time, and they responded. I think that's what's going on here. So we achieved this wide-ranging change in expectations, a matter of opinion, politics, social authority, all these things together gave a clear-cut message about reform. And that's what finally drove the great change. Now, I think that this expectation is the ultimate secret of progress in social policy. And how we did that is a precious, precious thing. We need to somehow understand that. We need to bottle it and sell it, because that is the real secret to overcoming poverty. Now, going forward, we need to apply that same approach somehow to other issues. Now, what does that mean concretely? I think there are a number of frontiers where we can work towards a broader work expectation, and which will both motivate people to work, and also we need to help them as well. One thing others have suggested, we need to reestablish welfare work programs. They weren't required to be maintained by states under TANF, and a lot of them have atrophied. States are really not doing a whole lot to place welfare mothers in jobs right now. We need to go back to that. We need to have a structure of welfare work programs such as we developed under the Family Support Act and then under TANF. And we need to go back to a serious welfare work structure. I agree with Sheldon. We need to make quite sure that work is available to people who are required to work. How to do that, however, requires some inquiry. The second thing is extend work requirements and work programs to other welfare programs, especially SNAP and public housing. And finally, we need to establish a comparable work structure for poor men who face work obligations. And here we're talking about men who owe child support and having trouble paying it because they don't have a steady work history. And the other one is men coming out of prison on parole who also have work problems. We need to help them work. We also need to require them to work, as we did with the mothers. With the mothers, it was a combination of help and hassle. Same for the men. They also need more help. They need wage subsidies. They need case management, placement. We need to build up a structure for them. It's really like welfare reform for men. That's the great frontier, to do for the men what we already did for the mothers. And if we do that, then I think we have a real chance to make a fundamental advance against family poverty.
Okay. So I think many of us forget, until Ron reminded us this morning, that welfare reform actually had several big changes. In addition to TANF, there were big changes in the child support program, and they were much less contentious than the changes in TANF. So, but the TANF reforms were built on research, well, played out research that had actually begun in the prior decade about the diversity of the TANF population, the big distinctions between long-term and short-term welfare recipients, and the distinction for short-term welfare recipients were they tended to be young, more likely to be minority women who had low skills, little work experience before they had a non-marital birth. And we sort of, the genius of the 1996 reform was we took that information and designed a reform system that would help different kinds of welfare recipients. And particularly, we provided not only work requirements, but work supports as well, particularly work supports aimed at that latter population. But the child support reforms were huge as well. And as I said, they were much less contentious. The game plan was to make sure that as mothers left the welfare system for work, they would take child support with them. So we required increases in paternity establishment for children who were born out of wedlock. We increased child support establishment rates. We instituted immediate wage withholding so that you would no longer have to chase after a guy if he failed to pay his child support. We automated the entire child support enforcement system, and we ensured that there was pass-through of child support to the mothers so that increasingly they would get the resources that the fathers were paying in support. So I can recall sitting in a room like this in around 1994, 1995, where the president of the National Child Support Enforcement Association opened up the meeting and said, The purpose of the forthcoming reform is to make sure that the adage that we all know, nothing is certain but death and taxes, that we added something to that. Nothing was certain but death, taxes, and child support. Right? At the time, I was relatively a newlywed. I was only married for about 20 years. And even I was shuddering in the room. Okay? So now, thanks to my wife, I've been married for 41 years. We celebrated our 41st anniversary. Congratulations, sweetie. But we never disaggregated the child support population, the non-custodial parent population, in the way we disaggregated the TANF population. And what we know, Elaine Sorensen and I, working in the Clinton administration, we did an analysis of, and what we showed was that the distribution of mothers by poverty status and child support receipt match incredibly the distribution of fathers by poverty status and whether or not they paid child support. In other words, the guys who didn't pay child support were just like the moms. They were low income, mostly oversampled minority men who had low skills before they had a non-marital birth. And against Wendell's advice, we titled the paper Deadbeats and Turnips in Child Support. But the point was, we had a plethora of low-income men who would not be able to meet these child support obligations that the child support system was making more sure as a consequence of the reform, and guess what we got? On the other end of reform, instead of increasing child support payments to low-income children who needed it most, we got increasing amounts of arrears for exactly those guys. We made the system certain to make sure that child support was collected, and if you didn't have it, your arrears simply rose. Elaine's research subsequent to that has shown that in several states where their efforts to automate child support were really, really effective, something like 80% of men who had arrears were men who earned $20,000 or less. So we now understand that the child support enforcement system, part of the reform, worked very well for men who were stably attached to the labor force, but for those who were tangentially attached to them, I call them vulnerable men in our society, particularly those who are chronically unemployed, the child support enforcement system encroached them, but it didn't work well for them, and as a consequence, they are stuck with growing arrears, and many states are trying to work with arrears abatement programs and some other things. So I think that we, in addition to what Larry talks about, welfare for men, we need to dial in on the child support enforcement reforms as well. We need to do things like, again, make sure that that child support orders are right-sized and that they are appropriate for a non-custodial parent's income in the first place. So if we have a child support order, child support orders are highly regressive, and which is one of the reasons why they often aren't paid. We also need to make sure that if non-custodial parents have arrears, they're able to modify their child support orders as the economy changes. And thirdly, we also know that from research that I've conducted recently, that during periods of high unemployment, child support payments decline, and they are especially likely to decline among low-income women on welfare. And so I think we need to match this, what Larry calls help and hassle. I call it require and enable. Yes, men should pay the non-custodial parents should pay the child support they owe, but they should be helped in doing so. And a big part of doing that is reforms in the child support enforcement system along the lines of the child support rule changes that that may not occur by the end of this administration, but which we might be able to revisit in the next one. Thanks.
Wow, it's so hard to follow up after all that information, incredible stuff there. So I'm just going to try and make a couple of sort of semi-random points that I think can help bring this together. One is why we sort of start with an assumption that we want everybody working, but we don't ever really talk about why. And I think we really can look at the fact that work is good as part of welfare reform for a couple of reasons. One is I think it's good for the poor themselves. We know that one of the roots out of poverty is having a job, that you're far less likely to be poor if you're employed than if you're not. And particularly if we want to talk about getting above sort of the maintenance level of poverty and actually getting moving up the economic ladder, having more and more economic mobility, employment is absolutely essential to it. So I think getting people into a job in some way is a key step on that ladder out of poverty. Second, I think it's good for overall for society as a whole. Larry talked a little bit about this consensus that was built around it, and that is part of the idea that if we're going to have a transfer system, if we're going to take from person A and give to person B, there needs to be some reciprocity in it in order to maintain support for that idea. Otherwise, person A is going to get pretty resentful after a while. So the idea that people who are person B are going to have to take steps an effort to get themselves out of welfare and to get themselves off the need for being redistributed to, that's sort of inherent in whatever social contract we have, and I think we have to maintain that. And third, and I think this is a little weaker, but I think it's also true that we actually need this overall for the economy. One of the problems we have with economic growth is a low labor force participation, and to the degree that we can move more people into the economy to have more people working, that's going to generate more wealth overall. And look, if you want to redistribute wealth, you have to have wealth in the first place. You don't do very good just redistributing poverty. You actually have to have jobs, have to have economic growth to do this. Second point I want to make is that I'm generally an opponent of paternalism in the welfare system. I don't like loading welfare benefits with a lot of requirements. I don't think necessarily we should be saying you can only have welfare if you do A, B, and C. You can't buy this. You have to do this. You have to go here and there. But I think the work requirement is a different sort of animal in this case, largely because it is responding to a problem that the welfare system itself creates, and that is a disincentive to employment. We can argue about exactly what is the marginal tax rate of people leaving welfare for work, but we know that if you leave welfare for work, you start, as you get more income, you start to lose your benefits, which offsets a lot of the income gains you're getting. You also start paying taxes, payroll tax on the first dollar you earn and so on. You also incur the expenses of going to work, from child care to transportation to clothing and so on, all of which diminishes the gains you receive if you leave welfare and go to work. If you're going to create a system that discourages you from taking that initial job, particularly if it's a low-skill, low-wage job, I think at the same time you can offset that by requiring that people do it anyway, even though if it's not in their short-term economic gain interest. It's in the long-term interest, but not necessarily in their short-term interest, and I think kind of pushing them to make that short-term step is a reasonable requirement. Third point is that I think we underestimate sometimes the importance of work as work. We tend to say, well, people shouldn't, low-income jobs, that starting job that's not going to pay enough. What we really need to do is teach people skills. We need them to get them going more to college. We need to have more job training programs, more of those sorts of things. I think more important is than that sometimes is the soft skills we've heard talked about earlier. That if at least in terms of both the people I talk about, the low-income people who are trying to get jobs that I talk about, and the employers and the charitable groups that are working with them, many times the problem isn't that the person isn't a computer programmer, it's that they don't yet understand how to interact with a boss, how it is to show up every day for work, how it is that they can't arrange their schedule around their other things they're doing. Those sort of soft skills are only taught by actually having a job and having to go out and do that every day. And I think that so simply getting people into an employment pattern of some kind is hugely important. And lastly, my point would be in terms of making job opportunities. I think job opportunities are hugely important. I am, as a non-Keynesian, very skeptical of the ability of government to simply create jobs and to simply employ people. But I do think there are things we can do to create more employment opportunities. I think things like criminal justice reform, dealing with the fact that people with a criminal history can't get employed, is a huge problem. I think we need to look at occupational licensure, things like that that prevent the ability of people to start businesses. I think we need to look at particularly property taxes and things like that that keep businesses locating from some inner urban areas that are a real problem. Zoning laws and things of that nature. I think there's a lot of things we can do before we get around to actually having the government step in and trying to create jobs. I just don't think it does a very good job of that.
Thank you very much. It was very helpful to get us going and thinking about these important issues. My first question, I want to get down in the weeds a little bit about the reform, and then I really want to move the conversation to many of the themes that you guys have brought up and the important issues and thinking looking forward. But just briefly, indulge me for a moment to look backwards. And the reason I want to, Robert basically said it's impossible to unpack the elements of reform and what it was that affected employment and caseload reduction. I think we would all agree that if we look back at the goals of the policy, the things that touch on what we're talking about in this panel, reduce dependency, increase employment, I think we would all agree that from the standpoint of the year 2000, welfare reform worked. Employment rates were up. We could quibble about the magnitudes of the other policies, the strong labor market and reform, but reform clearly had a role. So I think it's worth having a conversation that's a little bit more nuanced than your bottom line, Robert, about these critical elements of time limits, work requirements, sanctions, breaking the entitlement, about what we think really matters. And the reason why I think that's not a theoretical discussion is that there's a lot of conversation about exporting these policies to other elements of the social safety net. So I think it's incumbent on us to try to have some discussion about what we think mattered. What was it that might have made it work? At least starting and thinking about that initial period of in the strong economic economy, economic conditions.
I'll say a couple, so I can give you my own personal views about the components, and I think it has changed over time, as I said a minute ago. My view is that, and remember, so much of the reform looked like the impact was pretty fast in the first 3 to 4 or 5 years, poverty rates, employment rates, how they reacted then, and then they've kind of leveled out. What could have happened in those first 2 years? First of all, I don't think it was the block grant, because in fact, the states were awash with money initially, mm-hmm. because as the caseload fell and those grant, the levels of the block grant were pegged to the earlier caseloads, so they actually had so much money they didn't know what to do with it half the time. So I don't think it was the block grant. The time limits, at least if you were talking about 5 years, it wasn't approaching that fast. And sure, maybe some families were looking, 5 years ahead. I don't know if single mothers, living day to day are doing that, but maybe a little bit of it. But work requirements, immediate, okay? And furthermore, all the anecdotal evidence showed that work requirements were being enforced. And there were sanctions, they were being assessed, mm-hmm. Partial, full. It was there. So my view is that in that period, it was work requirements. It's relevant because we're talking a lot about work requirements here. And I think the major impact of work requirements was just driving people off the rolls. That was the major impact. You get them off welfare, and they all left. And they got sanctioned if they couldn't do it, or if they wanted to, they just didn't want to hassle with it, and they just went off. And when they went off, if you lose your welfare benefit, you got to work, okay? And 60 to 70% of them did. 40 to 30% of them did not work, and they went off anyway, and they went off to zero. So I would really assign that today, I would probably say the block grant is the major thing. I don't think today, with the states as little money as they have, now, admittedly, they've chosen to spend a lot of it on other stuff, but ignoring that for a second, I don't think that changing the work requirements today, there's not enough money for anybody. Everybody's off, you can't bring them back on if you don't have any money. So that's my feeling about it. Today, the block grant, is probably having the most impact of the reform. But back in the beginning, I think it was mostly work requirements.
Yeah, I would just I'd certainly agree with that. And I think the one point that Larry mentioned that I think is not right is that we should think about the TANF experience as having relevance for something like SNAP today. It may have had relevance for SNAP in the 1999 economy with 4% unemployment, but I don't see any way with the you could do the same. You could get the SNAP rolls down like you got the TANF rolls down, by saying if you don't work, you're off, and you'll get a lot of people off SNAP. But I don't see anything that will say you'll get the kind of increase employment you had back then, because I think a lot of what you have now are the people who couldn't work or couldn't work steadily at the time were getting AFDC and SNAP, and today they're just getting SNAP. And if you kick them off, then they'll be $2 a day and no SNAP as opposed to $2 a day in SNAP.
Can I just add something real quick? I don't want to talk to it, but just a little footnote on the research, since that was kind of my charge here. But we have some people in the audience here, you, Diane, Janet, who've all written reviews of the effect of food stamps on labor supply, and a lot of it does not show very big effects compared, particularly even to what AFDC, sometimes you got bigger. You guys can correct me because you're now all the surveyors, but you don't find, you know, you're just getting a food coupon. Okay, you're not going to quit, and if that's all you're getting, that's one of the explanations. But just stating as a fact on the research, it's actually kind of hard to find. You know, you found some, you know, back in the early days, you know, of the introduction overall for single mothers, but not for anybody else, but on average. Anyway, I want to throw that out there. You guys can easily comment, but I think that affects the food, the whole discussion of SNAP. Anyway, sorry.
I just want to just emphasize that work requirements were actually the most important part of the reform in terms of generating change. But I also want to note, again, that the nature of those requirements was not so much a specific legal rule, but this atmosphere of expectation about work, which the states generated. There's actually not much association between the degree of caseload fall at the state and whether the state had an ambitious welfare reform. The caseload fall is 60-70% across the whole country. And that's true even though local welfare policy and the extent of reform changed dramatically from place to place. So what's driving this isn't so much the specifics of policy, but a generalized attitude that now suddenly the work requirement is required. And that is what I think generated most of the change.
But I, you know, both in the first panel and through the discussion today, you know, there's been this underlying conversation about, okay, so how would we do some of this for non-custodial parents? And I think that's the big, if work requirements were critical in the early stages, then it's hard to imagine how changing requirements are going to work for creating a welfare program for men, because they don't get anything. And so it's as if they're receiving few benefits, so there's nothing that you can take away. And so as we imagine, you know, how to do that part of the puzzle, I think it really is important what Daniel Lichter was talking about in the prior panel, and that is that it could be that for 60-70% of the non-college population, they're going to migrate themselves into being non-resident fathers. It's going to be a much larger population than we're thinking about today.
It's a disaster.
And it's not only, I have to say, African-American and Latino men. We're talking about most men who do not have a four-year college degree. So those men are, those mostly non-custodial parents, mostly men, are going to be under the custody of the child support enforcement system, right? So you can't give them anything, but you can treat them in a way that makes more sense.
Why can't we give them wage subsidies?
Well, you could, right? It's as if the custodian of those men is the child support enforcement system, and part of the things that we sort of have to, the incentives and the requirements that we're working with them have to do with, an expansion of the earned income tax credit in a way that understands that they are not childless people. They are. We expect them to work. We expect them to support their children. But in the same way that we required and enabled moms to go to work, we have to require and enable them to do the same thing. And the buttons are, a big part of the buttons are in the child support enforcement system and in the criminal justice system. Yeah.
I just want to throw in another confounding factor sort of to this evaluation. That is I think the danger of trying to take TANF or AFDC as a discrete program by itself, independent of the rest of the social safety net. Basically, I mean, we talk about TANF going down in real terms, but social welfare spending hasn't. I mean, basically, we simply shifted from cash benefits to non-cash benefits. And I personally think that's a mistake. I think cash is much better as a benefit than sort of treating people like they're getting allowance and here's your food and here's your health care and here's your housing. I mean, I think people should be able to make their own budgetary decisions in terms of cash. But I think, you know, I think when we look at the results of these things, it's not necessarily say, well, person responded because their cash benefits were cut, but at the same time we gave them more of these other type of benefits. I think you've got to take all of that into account as a whole.
Well, that's a really great point that pivots me to the next thing that I want to talk about. And to use the language that Sheldon used in his opening statement, I really want to dig into the distributional piece of this, because I think that much of what we heard in the first panel is very optimistic, and I respect and appreciate those broad trends that Janet was educating us all about. But in addition to your point, Mike, about moving from cash to non-cash, I think the first order thing we did that was even more important than that is moving the marginal assistance from the deep poor to the near poor. And so, you know, basically the social compact is you got to work, And as I've already forgotten who said it, I think Sheldon again, it's probably, you know, one of the better times to be a low-skilled, working, poor individual if you can get work, in the sense of the work supports that we're putting on, the earned income tax credit, men aside, without children aside, SNAP, which is really primarily an in-work support program. We have more to do, but putting that aside for a second, what is equally clear is that we've taken away the fundamental safety net at the bottom. We've reduced it dramatically by the fact that TANF essentially doesn't exist anymore. We had this great recession that was bigger than anything we've seen before. The caseloads barely budged. They didn't go up by more in states that had a bigger economic states shock than. So that seems to me to be the best test of the social safety net possible, and it clearly failed. So the question is, where are the gaps, and what do we do about that? Let's unpack that distributional piece a little bit.
Well, I'm reminded, I think it's from Peter the Citizen, who said work works, but TANF doesn't. I mean, I mean TANF seems hopeless in this regard, precisely because the block grant is so low, states don't have any money. Mm-hmm. The promising thing is the TANF Emergency Fund, I think, bipartisan support. You could call it the Emergency Jobs Fund. You don't have to tie it to TANF. It could be available to ex-offenders. It could be available to people who have child support arrears. So we do have, you know, it wasn't experimentally evaluated, but work by Mark Elliott and Donna Pavetti and others seems to show it was popular with Republican and other governors. So I think that's a way to start for a large group of people who are not going to get jobs in the current economy.
I just want to say that I don't think the detached mothers was part of the plan for TANF. The detached mothers are occurring mostly, as I understand it, because states are making it very hard to apply for aid. And even mothers who qualify for aid are not allowed even to apply, in effect, in many states. I mean, Illinois is the case in the Eden and Schaefer book, mm-hmm. but there are other cases, too. Now, as I understand it, that's contrary to the intention of TANF. TANF did not say you close the door to aid.
Right.
It said if you go on aid, you are expected to work. But the work expectation doesn't apply to everybody on the caseload. It's 50% of the caseload. States can exempt 20% of their cases from that requirement. It's not a universal requirement that applies instantly to everyone. So I don't see a reason why hardship cases should ever have occurred under TANF. And as Robert also said, the SNAP system allows them to track many, many, many people who have left Cash Aid but are still getting SNAP. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why these families have to be out in the cold. So I see this really as an implementation issue, an administrative oversight issue. States are, I think, abusing the TANF system not to help these people. It's quite possible to do that and still maintain the work requirements.
Well, that tees money, up though. Our next panel, but yeah.
They don't have any money, though. I mean, you know.
Well,
what
but
are
that's because of another abuse. States are transferring too much of the TANF money away from TANF.
Yeah,
I think that it's a mistake to look. I mean, I think that it's targeting as much as it is total dollar amounts.
Right.
That I mean, if you look at how much we actually spend on anti-poverty programs, you could divide it up and theoretically eliminate poverty if you just gave a check to every poor person. Doesn't happen in part because we subsidize people above the poverty level, and in many cases we miss people below the poverty level. I think the EITC is a very good example of this, where the size of your subsidy depends as much on family size as it does on whether you're, you know, a low-income, working, single, childless man is not going to get much of any or if anything out of the EITC, whereas a large family gets a big benefit, even well up the income ladder. So, I mean, I think that we need to do a better job of focusing on what it is that we want to do. If what we're going to do is try to maintain a level below which we want no one to fall, then that should be our target, not necessarily to do a whole bunch of other social engineering things over and above that level.
But I also think, again, in looking at the structure of the earned income tax credit, and when you think about, so the proposals in New York, the proposals in Atlanta that have thought about how to modify the earned income tax credit for childless workers or for non-custodial parents. You know, those reforms take the maximum benefit up to about $1,000, whereas so this is what I've never been able to get my mind around. So the EITC, as we currently have it, will provide up to close to $6,000 for a single mom with two children. Part of the purpose, Janet used the word reward work. I would say incent work. And so it makes no sense to me whatsoever that the father of her child, even though she has custody of the child, gets about $500 from their income tax credit. So it gets a tenth of the benefit that she's supposed to get if part of it is to incent work. So it just makes no sense. We have to reform the structure of the EITC so that it says, you know, the EITC was intended to do things. It was intended to encourage work, but also to help reduce poverty among families with children. And so we've got to pay attention to those two things. Work, we're going to incent work, but we're also going to say that if you have children that you have to support, you know, we have to provide an incentive for you to work. And when you go out to, you know, above $20,000, the amount that low-income single men who have child support orders get out of the earning income tax credit is virtually nothing. And so that's part of the frontier as well, I think.
So do we, we're about ready to move on to the questions, but is there a consensus on this panel that we could support what Sheldon labeled as a partial disability? So is part of the solution to this gap or distributional piece about perhaps, you know, ignoring the deep poor, the hard to employ, aside from work opportunities? Is that the solution? How would we do that?
We need to have aid for people who can't immediately work. That doesn't mean we have to label them as disabled. I think that's a mistake. If you do that, you then really can't ever expect work. I'd rather say there are some people who are employable, but whose lives are confused. And right now they need to have aid, but in a short period after that, depending on how things go, they will be expected to work. That is the TANF model. I don't see why we need to go beyond that.
Well, I think Becky Blank has a Hamilton Project paper on this issue, so I won't say
a lot. Temporary emergency assistance.
Mm-hmm. Essentially assistance.
Well, why do we need a new benefit when TANF should cover
this? Because
these
the current TANF program is such a mess. I'm not sure I would expect them to do anything. I mean, reform, you know, but...
Marion Bittler and I have a Hamilton Project piece for precisely how to move forward with TANF.
You've got to end this panel on a more positive note. Do something for me.
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's important to talk about these trade-offs, and I think that there's, you know, to kind of wrap up as we transition to the questions, I think there are success stories here. I mean, I think that we know, and this is, again, echoing some of the things on the first panel, that we know that putting work supports in place make things work. And so I think that's TANF surely is part of that constellation of the stick part of the carrots and sticks. But I think that I personally think that the important thing going forward is thinking about how to deal with those that can't temporarily or for more longer term periods of time work within that structure. And so that's the best I can do, Ron. Is that okay?
That's good.
Okay. So with that, let us turn to the questions from the audience. How about here, right there. Thank you. Sorry. I
was supposed to call. Jenny Genzer from the USDA Food and Nutrition Service. I've been reading a lot of articles about how work is disappearing. Truck drivers may be obsolete in 10 or 15 years with self-driving vehicles. More and more things are becoming automated. How does that affect our whole society and TANF if there are fewer and fewer jobs of any kind?
So I think it's instructive to hear what Jane Waldfogel was saying in the first panel about how home health care jobs, et cetera, were the jobs of first resorts for single mothers when they left welfare. So it could be, you know, of course, the nature and the complexion of our economy is changing, but personal service jobs are rising, you know, and so along with this idea that there is a cohort of people whose skills are very low, personal service, and that is important to sort of have an expectation that people work. At the same time that manufacturing jobs may be declining, there's a boom in other sorts of work and personal service jobs. I think we have to look at, and increasingly with jobs that do not require a college degree. But we have to then, so we have those as opportunities to execute a work-based system and to expand a work-based system. And I think it's important to sort of take advantage of that. But I also think it's important to for some of the populations that we're talking about to increase their levels of education. So I'm doing some work around the impacts of fathers' financial contributions to children on children's well-being. So I understand that from the vantage point of equity, taxpayers don't want to pay for other people's children. We don't want mothers only to be supporting children. We want fathers to be able to do it as well. But low-income men may be paying 6% of total household income for a single mother and child, a minuscule portion of it. And even when they pay child support, its impacts on cognitive development, academic achievement, and behavior are just so small. And so, yes, we do need to have a work-based system, but we have to understand what we're getting out of it. And what we're getting out of it at those levels of support is very, very little for the children that are involved, although it may make a huge difference for taxpayers, it may make a huge difference for equity in terms of mothers and kids.
I think we should note that this is not the first time in history this has occurred, though. We heard this once when people left agriculture and went to work. And it was, oh, my God, if nobody's farming, what is everybody going to do? Everybody can't go in and run a loom. Well, and then we had the Industrial Revolution, and it was, oh, my God, we got steam engines now. What happened to all those people who were working on the loom? What are they going to do now? And now we're hearing it, this is, again, that there's not any jobs because of the change. I don't know if this time is different or not. I mean, it could be quantitatively different, but I think there's a word of caution involved in this, the end of work type of thing is worth.
Well, I would just say that it is interesting that there's a group in Silicon Valley who clearly believe the future is a lot more labor-saving technology, as you suggest, and they are experimenting with guaranteed annual incomes. Mm-hmm. And I heard somebody say, now, they're technology optimists, and I think your point is clear that we've heard this before, but there's some technology optimists who think you're going to have labor-saving technological change in personal services as well as truck drivers. And I heard somebody say at a conference, serious person, well, so what if half the population lives on a guaranteed annual income? We'll be all the more productive. And we'll be able to increase the guaranteed annual income every year as some form of social dividend. So, you know, it's a little bit science fiction at this point. But they did just start self-driving Ubers in Pittsburgh last week. So,
other questions? How about in the back row in the yellow?
How much does social promotion in school lead to eventual poverty, and do we perhaps need to address that first?
Could you elaborate?
If particularly in areas of high poverty or unemployment or underemployment, it seems that there's a correlation between those areas and the schools which consistently are at the lowest possible rating.
Well, the quality of schools in high segregated, low-income neighborhoods, independent of whatever promotion practices they have, is very poor. And I'm not an expert on this, but Sean Reardon has recently written papers where you can look at differences in test scores by school district. So I think it's not anything relevant to what we've talked about here, but there's a whole education literature going on. And if Sean were here, I think he'd have an answer.
Yeah. How about one more question here at the front in the white shirt?
Thanks. Two quick questions. One, is there variation across in terms of outcomes across different groups and across regions? So, for example, do you get different outcomes for across different racial groups in different areas of the country, in different cities, in different states? If someone can kind of talk about that. And then secondly, in terms of the outcome regarding the increased labor force participation, is that really about the expectation or the requirement that people work? Or could it also be about states creating an infrastructure to facilitate people working so that because now you've got, because states take it more seriously to get people from not working to working, might that have an impact as well?
Just to answer the last question, it's both. I mean, it's both creating opportunities for or job creation, creating more opportunities for people to work. And, you know, we have a disagreement about how you get there, but agreeing that we need to do that. And I think about encouraging people and finding ways to encourage them to take those jobs that are available when they become available.
I'd only say that the general movement towards work off welfare was remarkably uniform across mm-hmm. the country, regardless of what states actually did to reform welfare. However, it's still the case that states that were more ambitious and which set up a more elaborate institutional structure with more support, I'm thinking of New York City, also Wisconsin, they also achieved some other goals besides just moving people into work. They got better quality jobs, they stayed in the jobs longer, et cetera, et cetera. So there's still some importance in how you do it and how well you do it in the local level.
But I think the other thing, I heard your question differently. In the case of a population where we didn't have many levers, namely less educated men, their declines in young labor force participation among less educated has been across the board. And so you don't have a lot of variation across states, and intertemporally, the decline in the labor force participation and their hours of work is scary. The proportion of young men who have no more than a high school diploma who have never worked by age 18 to 24 is beginning to be really, really staggering. And I will, if I get the last word, point out that this is not only among African American and Latino among young men generally. So this is a big thing that we have to worry about.
Okay, well, I want to thank our panelists. Before we give them a round of applause, I want to let you know that there will be lunch served outside. Everybody is welcome. Take your food where you can. And we'll be back with the next panel led by Jim Ziliak on state policies at 1:15. So thank you very much.